submarine and could have broken Lloyd in two pieces with one hand while making a daiquiri with the other if he had wanted to. According to Carl, he had killed several men during the course of his long and checkered career, and Lloyd tended to believe him. Not that Lloyd was physically afraid of Carl Huff. The pilot was big and tough, but he was as leery of the walkin' dude as anyone else in the West, and Lloyd wore Flag's charm. But he was one of their flyers, and because he was, he had to be handled diplomatically. And oddly enough, Lloyd was something of a diplomat. His credentials were simple, but awesome. He had spent several weeks with a certain madman named Poke Freeman, and had lived to tell the tale. He had also spent several months with Randall Flagg, and was still drawing air and in his right mind. Carl had come in around 2 on September 12th, his cycle helmet under one arm. There was an ugly burn on his left cheek and blisters on one hand. There had been a fire. Bad, but not as bad as it could have been. A fuel truck had exploded, spewing burning petroleum all over the tarmac area. "All right," Lloyd had said. "I'll see that the big guy knows. The guys that got hurt are at the infirmary?" "Yeah, they are. I don't think Freddy Campanari is going to live to see the sun go down. That leaves two pilots, me and Andy. Tell him that, and tell him something else when he gets back. I want that fuck trash can man gone. That's my price for staying." Lloyd gazed at Carl Huff. "Is it? You're damned well told." "Well, I tell you, Carl," Lloyd said, "I can't pass that message on. If you want to give orders to him, you'll have to do it yourself." Carl looked suddenly confused and a little afraid. Fear sat strangely on that craggy face. "Yeah, I see your point. I'm just tired and fucked over, Lloyd. My face hurts like hell. I don't mean to take it out on you." "That's okay, man. That's what I'm here for." Sometimes he wished it wasn't. Already his head was starting to ache. Carl said, "But he's got to go. If I have to tell him that, I will. I know he's got one of those black stones. He's ace high with the tall man, I guess. But hey, listen." Carl sat down and put his helmet on a baccarat table. "Trash was responsible for that fire. My Christ, how are we ever going to get those planes up if one of the big guy's men is torching the fucking pilots?" Several people passing through the lobby of the Grand glanced uneasily over at the table where Lloyd and Carl sat. "Keep your voice down, Carl." "Okay, but you see the problem, don't you?" "How sure are you the trash did it?" "Listen," Carl said, leaning forward. "He was in the motor pool, all right? In there for a long time. Lots of guys saw him, not just me. I thought he was out someplace, in the desert, you know, looking for stuff. Well, he came back, all right. That sand crawler he takes out was full of stuff. God knows where he gets it, I sure don't. Well, he had the guys in stitches at coffee break. You know how he is. To him, weaponry is like candy is to a kid." "Yeah. The last thing he showed us was one of those incendiary fuses. You pull the tab and there's this little burst of phosphorus. Then nothing for half an hour or 40 minutes, depending on the size of the fuse, all right? You get it? Then there's one hell of a fire, small but very intense." "Yeah. So, okay. Trashy's showing us, just about drooling over the thing, in fact, and Freddy Campanari says, 'Hey, people who play with fire wet the bed, Trash.' And Steve Tobin, you know him, he's funny like a rubber crutch. He says, 'You guys better put away your matches, Trashy's back in town.' And Trash got really weird. He looked around at us and he muttered under his breath. I was sitting right next to him and it sounded like he said, 'Don't ask me about old Lady Semple's check no more.' That make any sense to you?" Lloyd shook his head. Nothing about the trash can man made much sense to him. "Then he just left, picked up the stuff he was showing us and took off. Well, none of us felt very good about it. We didn't mean to hurt his feelings. Most of the guys really liked Trash. Or they did. He's like a little kid, you know." Lloyd nodded. "An hour later, that goddamn fuel truck goes up like a rocket. And while we're picking up the pieces, I happen to look up, and there's Trashy over in his sand crawler by the barracks building, watching us with binoculars." "Is that all you've got?" Lloyd asked, relieved. "No, it ain't. If it was, I wouldn't even have bothered to come see you, Lloyd. But it got me thinking about how that truck went up. That's just the sort of thing you use an incendiary fuse for. In Nam, the Kong blew up a lot of our ammo dumps just that way, with our own fucking incendiary fuses. Stick it under the truck, on the exhaust pipe. If no one starts the truck up, it goes when the timer runs out. If someone does, it goes when the pipe gets hot. Either way, kaboom! No more truck. The only thing that didn't fit was there's always a dozen fuel trucks in the motor pool, and we don't use them in any particular order. So after we got poor old Freddy over to the infirmary, John Waite and I went over there. John's in charge of the motor pool, and he was just about pissing himself. He'd seen trash in there earlier. He was sure it was Trash Can Man? With those burns all the way up his arm, it's kind of hard to make a mistake, wouldn't you say? All right. No one thought anything of it then. He was just poking around, but that's his job, ain't it? Yes, I guess you'd have to say it is. So me and John start to look over the rest of the fuel trucks. And holy shit, there's an incendiary fuse on every one of them. He put them on the exhaust pipes just below the fuel tanks themselves. The reason the truck we were using went first was because the exhaust pipe got hot, like I just told you, all right? But the others were getting ready to go. Two or three were starting to smoke. Some of the trucks were empty, but at least five of them were full of jet fuel. Another 10 minutes and we would have lost half the goddamn base. Oh, Jesus, Lloyd thought mournfully. It really is bad. Just about as bad as it can get. Carl held up his blistered hand. I got this pulling one of the hot ones. Now do you see why he's got to go? Lloyd said hesitantly. Maybe someone stole those fuses out of the back of his sandcrawler while he was taking a leak or something. Carl said patiently, That's not how it happened. Someone hurt his feelings while he was showing off his toys and he tried to burn us all up. He damn near succeeded. Something's got to be done, Lloyd. All right, Carl. He spent the rest of the afternoon asking around about trash. Had anyone seen him or know where he might be? Guarded looks and negative answers. Word had gotten around. Maybe that was good. Anyone who did see him would be quick to report it in hopes of having a good word put in on their behalf with the big guy. But Lloyd had a hunch that no one was going to see Trash. He had given them a little hot foot and had gone running back into the desert in his sand crawler. He looked down at the solitaire game spread out in front of him and carefully controlled an urge to sweep the whole thing onto the floor. Instead, he cheated out another ace and went on playing. It didn't matter. When Flag wanted him, he would just reach out and gather him up. Old Trashy was going to end up riding a cross piece just like Heck Drogan. Hard luck, guy. But in his secret heart, he wondered. Things had happened lately that he didn't like. Dana, for instance. Flag had known about her, that was true, but she hadn't talked. She had somehow escaped into death instead, leaving them no further ahead in the matter of the third spy. That was another thing. How come Flag didn't just know about the third spy? He had known about the old fart, and when he had come back from the desert he had known about Dana and had told them exactly how he was going to handle her. But it hadn't worked. And now, Trash Can Man. Trash wasn't a nobody. Maybe he had been back in the old days, but not anymore. He wore the black man's stone just as he himself did. After Flag had crisped that big-mouth lawyer's brains in L.A., Lloyd had seen Flag lay his hands on Trash Can's shoulders and tell him gently that all the dreams had been true dreams. And Trash had whispered, "My life for you." Lloyd didn't know what else might have passed between them, but it seemed clear that he had wandered the desert with Flag's blessing. And now, Trash Can Man had gone berserk. Which raised some pretty serious questions. Which was why Lloyd was sitting here alone at 9 in the evening, cheating at solitaire and wishing he was drunk. "Mr. Henreid?" "Now what?" He looked up and saw a girl with a pretty, pouty face, tight white shorts. a halter that didn't quite cover the areoli of her nipples. Sex pot type for sure, but she looked nervous and pale, almost ill. She was biting compulsively at one of her thumbnails, and he saw that all her nails were bitten and ragged. "What?"
I have to see Mr. Flagg," she said.
The strength went rapidly out of her voice, and it ended as a whisper. "You do, huh? What do you think, I am his social secretary?"
"But they said to see you."
"Who did?"
"Well, Angie Hirschfield did. It was her."
"What's your name?"
Julie."
She giggled, but it was only a reflex. The scared look never left her face, and Lloyd wondered wearily what sort of shit was up in the fan now. A girl like this wouldn't ask for Flagg unless it was very serious indeed.
"Julie Laurie."
"Well, Julie Laurie, Flagg isn't in Las Vegas now."
"When will he be back?"
"I don't know. He comes and goes, and he doesn't wear a beeper. He doesn't explain himself to me either. If you have something, give it to me, and I'll see that he gets the message." She looked at him doubtfully, and Lloyd repeated what he had told Carl Huff that afternoon. "It's what I'm here for, Julie."
"Okay."
Then in a rush,
"If it's important, you tell him I'm the one told you, Julie Laurie."
"Okay."
"You won't forget?"
"No, for Christ's sake. Now what is it?" She pouted.
"Well, you don't have to be so mean about it."
He sighed and put the handful of cards he had been holding down on the table. "No," he said, "I guess I don't. Now what is it?"
"That dummy. If he's around, I figure he's spying. I just thought you should know."
Her eyes glinted viciously.
"Motherfucker pulled a gun on me."
"What dummy?"
"Well, I saw the retard, so I figured the dummy must be with him, you know. And they're just not our type. I figured they must have come from the other side."
"That's what you figure, huh?"
"Yeah."
"Well, I don't know what the Christ you're talking about. It's been a long day and I'm tired. If you don't start talking some sense, Julie, I'm going up to bed."
Julie sat down, crossed her legs, and told Lloyd about her meeting with Nick Andros and Tom Cullen in Pratt, Kansas, her hometown.
About the Pepto-Bismol.
"I was just having a little fun with the softy, and this deaf and dumb pulls a gun on me."
She even told him about shooting at them as they left town.
"Which all proves what?" Lloyd asked when she finished.
He had been a little intrigued with the word spy, but since then had lapsed into a semi-daze of boredom. Julie pouted again and lit a cigarette.
"I told you. That Phoebe, he's over here now. I just bet he's spying."
"Tom Cullen, you said his name was?"
"Yes."
He had the vaguest sort of memory. Cullen was a big blonde guy, a few cards short the deck for sure, but surely not as bad as this high-iron bitch was making out. He tried for more and came up empty. People were still streaming into Vegas in numbers of 60 to 100 a day. It was becoming impossible to keep them all straight, and Flagg said the immigration was going to get a lot heavier before it tapered off. He supposed he could go to Paul Burleson, who was keeping a file of Vegas residents, and find something out about this Cullen dude.
"Are you going to arrest him?" Julie asked.
Lloyd looked at her. "I'll arrest you if you don't get off my case," he said.
"Nice fucking guy,"
Julie Laurie cried, her voice rising shrewishly. She jumped to her feet, glaring at him. In her tight white cotton shorts, her legs seemed to go all the way up to her chin.
"Try to do you a favor."
"I'll check it."
"Yeah, right, I know that story."
She stomped off, Fanny swinging in tight little circles of indignation. Lloyd watched her with a certain weary amusement, thinking there were a lot of chicks like her in the world. Even now, after the superflu, he was willing to bet there were a lot around. Easy to slap the make on, but watch out for the fingernails afterward. Kissing cousins to those spiders that gobble up their mates after sex. 2 months had gone by, and she still bore that mute guy a grudge. What did she say his name was? Andros? Lloyd pulled a battered black notebook from his back pocket, wet his finger, and paged over to a blank sheet. This was his memory book, and it was chock full of little notes to himself. Everything from a reminder to take a shave before meeting with Flagg, to a boxed memorandum to get the contents of Las Vegas's pharmacies inventoried before they started to lose morphine and codeine. It would be time to get another little book soon. In his flat and scrawling grammar school script, he wrote, "Nick Andros or maybe Androtes, mute, in town?" And below that, "Tom Cullen, check out with Paul." He tucked the book back into his pocket. 40 miles northeast, the dark man had consummated his long-term relationship with Nadine Cross under the glittering desert stars. He would have been very interested to know that a friend of Nick Andros's was in Las Vegas. But he slept. Lloyd looked morosely down at his solitaire game, forgetting about Julie Lawrie and her grudge and her tight little ass. He cheated out another ace, and his thoughts turned dolefully back to the trash can man, and what Flagg might say, or do, when Lloyd told him. At the same time Julie Lawrie was leaving the Cub Bar, feeling shat upon for doing no more than what she saw as her civic duty, Tom Cullen stood by the picture window of his apartment in another part of the city, looking dreamily out at the full moon. It was time to go. Time to go back. This apartment was not like his house in Boulder. This place was furnished, but not decorated. He had not put up so much as a single poster or hung a single stuffed bird from piano wire. This place had been only a way station, and now it was time to go on. He was glad. He hated it here. It had a kind of smell to it here, a dry and rotten smell that you could never quite put your finger on. The people were mostly nice, and some of them he liked every bit as well as the people in Boulder, folks like Angie and that little boy, Dinny. No one made fun of him because he was slow. They had given him a job and joked with him, and on lunch break they'd trade out of their dinner buckets for something out of someone else's that looked better. They were nice folks. Not much different from Boulder folks, as far as he could tell, but they had that smell about them. They all seemed to be waiting and watching. Sometimes strange silences fell among them, and their eyes seemed to glaze over, as if they were all having the same uneasy dream. They did things without asking for explanations of why they were doing them or what it was for. It was as if these people were wearing happy folks' faces, but their real faces, their underneath faces, were monster faces. He had seen a scary movie about that once. That kind of monster was called a werewolf. The moon rode over the desert, ghostly, high, and free. He had seen Dana from the Free Zone. He had seen her once and never again. What had happened to her? Had she been spying too? Had she gone back? He didn't know, but he was afraid. There was a small knapsack in the lazy boy chair that faced the apartment's useless color console TV. The knapsack was full of vacuum-sealed ham strips and Slim Jims and saltines. He picked it up and put it on. Travel at night, sleep in the day. He stepped out into the courtyard of the building without a backward glance. The moon was so bright that he cast a shadow on the cracked cement where the would-be high rollers had once parked their cars with the out-of-state plates. He looked up at the ghostly coin that floated in the sky. "M-O-O-N. That spells moon," he whispered. "Laws, yes. Tom Cullen knows what that means." His bike was leaning against the pink stucco wall of the apartment building. He paused once to adjust his knapsack, then got on and set off for the interstate. By 11 p.m. he had cleared Las Vegas and was pedaling east in the breakdown lane of I-15. No one saw him. No alarm was raised. His mind dropped into a soft neutral, as it almost always did when the most immediate things were taken care of. He biked steadily along, conscious only that the light night breeze felt nice against his sweaty face. Every now and then he had to swerve around a sand dune that had crept out of the desert and had lain a white skeletal arm across the road, and once he was well away from the city there were stalled cars and trucks to contend with, too. "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair," Glenn Bateman might have said in his ironic way. He stopped at 2 in the morning for a light lunch of Slim Jims, crackers, and Kool-Aid from the big thermos strapped to the back of the bike. Then he went on. The moon was down. Las Vegas fell farther behind with every revolution of his bicycle tires. That made him feel good. But at 4:15 on that morning of September 13th, a cold coma of fear washed over him. It was made all the more terrifying by virtue of its unexpectedness, by its seeming irrationality. Tom would have cried out loud, but his vocal cords were suddenly frozen, locked. The muscles in his pumping legs went slack, and he coasted along under the stars. The black and white negative of the desert streamed by more and more slowly. He was near. The man with no face, the demon who now walked the earth. Flag. The tall man, they called him. The grinning man, Tom called him in his heart. Only when his grin fell on you, all the blood in your body fell into a dead swoon, leaving your flesh cold and gray. The man who could look at a cat and make it puke up hairballs. If he walked through a building project, men would hammer their own thumbnails and put shingles on upside down and sleepwalk off the ends of girders and... Oh, dear God, he was awake! A whimper escaped Tom's throat. He could feel the sudden wakefulness. He seemed to see, feel, an eye opening in the darkness of the early morning, a dreadful red eye that was still a bit bleared and confused with sleep. It was turning in the darkness, looking, looking for him. It knew Tom Cullen was there, but not just where he was. Numbly, his feet found the pedals, and he biked on, faster and faster, bending over the handlebars to cut down the wind resistance, picking up speed until he was nearly flying along. If he had come upon a wrecked car in his path, he would have pedaled into it full tilt and perhaps killed himself. But little by little, he could feel that dark, hot presence falling behind him. And the greatest wonder was that that awful red eye had glanced his way, had passed over him without seeing. Maybe because I'm bent over my handlebars so far, Tom Cullen reasoned incoherently. And then it had closed again. The dark man had gone back to sleep. How does the rabbit feel when the shadow of the hawk falls on him like a dark crucifix, and then goes on without stopping or even slowing? How does the mouse feel when the cat, who has been crouched patiently outside his hole for the entire day, is picked up by its master and tossed unceremoniously out the front door? How does the deer feel when it steps quietly past the mighty hunter who is snoozing away the effects of his 3 lunchtime beers? Perhaps they feel nothing, or perhaps they feel what Tom Cullen felt as he rode out of that black and dangerous sphere of influence. A great and nearly electrifying sunburst of relief, a feeling of new birth, most of all, a feeling of safety scarcely earned, that such great good luck must surely be a sign from heaven. He rode on until 5 o'clock in the morning. Ahead of him, the sky was turning the dark blue laced with gold of sunrise. The stars were fading. Tom was almost done in. He went on a little farther, then spotted a sharp decline about 70 yards to the right of the highway. He pushed his bike over and then down into the dry wash. Consulting the tickings and workings of instinct, he pulled enough dry grass and mesquite to cover most of the bike. There were 2 big rocks leaning against each other about 10 yards from his bike. He crawled into the pocket of shade beneath them, put his jacket under his head, and was asleep almost at once. Chapter 67. The walkin' dude was back in Vegas. He had gotten in around 9:30 in the morning. Lloyd had seen him arrive. Flagg had also seen Lloyd, but had taken no notice of him. He had been crossing the lobby of the Grand, leading a woman. Heads turned to look at her, in spite of everyone's nearly unanimous aversion to looking at the dark man. Her hair was a uniform snow-white. She had a terrible sunburn, one so bad that it made Lloyd think of the victims of the gasoline fire at Indian Springs. White hair, horrible sunburn, utterly empty eyes. They looked out at the world with a lack of expression that was beyond placidity, even beyond idiocy. Lloyd had seen eyes like that once before, in Los Angeles, after the dark man had finished with Eric Strellerton, the lawyer who was going to tell Flagg how to run everything. Flagg looked at no one. He grinned. He led the woman to the elevator and inside. The doors slid shut behind them, and they went up to the top floor. For the next 6 hours, Lloyd was busy trying to get everything organized, so when Flagg called him and asked for a report, he would be ready. He thought everything was under control. The only item left was tracking down Paul Burleson and getting whatever he had on this Tom Cullen, just in case Julie Laurie really had stumbled onto something. Lloyd didn't think it likely, but with Flagg it was better to be safe than sorry. Much better. He picked up the telephone and waited patiently. After a few moments, there was a click, and then Shirley Dunbar's Tennessee twang was in his ear.
"Operator?"
"Hi, Shirley, it's Lloyd."
"Lloyd Henreid, how are you?"
"Not too bad, Cheryl. Can you try 6214 for me?"
"Paul? He's not home. He's out at Indian Springs. Bet I could catch him for you at base ops."
"Okay, try that."
"You bet. Say, Lloyd, when are you going to come over and try some of my coffee cake? I bake fresh every 2-3 days.
"Soon, Shirley," Lloyd said, grimacing. Shirley was 40, ran about 180, and had set her cap for Lloyd. He took a lot of ribbing about her, especially from Whitney and Ronnie Sykes. But she was a fine telephone operator, able to do wonders with the Las Vegas phone system. Getting the phones working, the most important ones anyway, had been their first priority after the power, but most of the automatic switching equipment had burned out. So they were back to the equivalent of tin cans and lots of waxed string. There were also constant outages. Shirley handled what there was to handle with uncanny skill, and she was patient with the 3 or 4 other operators who were still learning. Also, she did make nice coffee cake. "Real soon," he added, and thought how nice it would be if Julie Laurie's firm, rounded body could be grafted onto Shirley Dunbar's skills and gentle, uncomplaining nature. She seemed satisfied. There were beeps and boops on the line, and one high-pitched, echoing whine that made him hold the handset away from his ear, grimacing. Then the phone rang at the other end in a series of hoarse burrs.
"Bailey, ops," a voice made tinny by distance said.
"This is Lloyd," he bellowed into the phone. "Is Paul there?"
"Oh, what, Lloyd?" Bailey asked.
"Paul! Paul Burleson!"
"Oh, him, yeah, he's right here having a Coca-Cola."
There was a pause. Lloyd began to think that the tenuous connection had been broken, and then Paul came on.
"We're going to have to shout, Paul. The connection stinks."
Lloyd wasn't completely sure that Paul Burleson had the lung capacity to shout. He was a scrawny little man with thick lenses in his glasses, and some men called him Mr. Cool because he insisted on wearing a complete 3-piece suit each day despite the dry crunch of the Vegas heat. But he was a good man to have as your information officer, and Flagg had told Lloyd in one of his expansive moods that by 1991 Burleson would be in charge of the secret police. "And he'll be so good at it," Flagg had added with a warm and loving smile. Paul did manage to speak a little louder.
"Have you got your directory with you?" Lloyd asked.
"Yes. Stan Bailey and I were going over a work rotation program."
"See if you got anything on a guy named Tom Cullen, would you?"
"Just a second."
A second stretched out to 2 or 3 minutes, and Lloyd began to wonder again if they had been cut off. Then Paul said,
"Okay, Tom Cullen. You there, Lloyd?"
"Right here."
"You can never be sure with the phones the way they are." "He's somewhere between 22 and 35, at a guess. He doesn't know for sure. Light mental retardation. He has some work skills. We've had him on the cleanup crew."
"How long has he been in Vegas?"
"Something less than 3 weeks."
"From Colorado?"
"Yes, but we have a dozen people over here who tried it over there and decided they didn't like it. They drove this guy out. He was having sex with a normal woman, and I guess they were afraid for their gene pool."
Paul laughed.
"Got his address?"
Paul gave it to him, and Lloyd jotted it down in his notebook.
"That it, Lloyd?"
"One other name, if you've got the time."
Paul laughed, a small man's fussy laugh.
"Sure, it's only my coffee break."
"The name is Nick Andros."
Paul said instantly,
"I have that name on my red list."
"Oh?" Lloyd thought as quickly as he could,
which was far from the speed of light. He had no idea what Paul's red list might be.
"Who gave you his name?"
Exasperated, Paul said, "Who do you think? The same person that gave me all the red list names."
"Oh, okay."
He said goodbye and hung up. Small talk was impossible with the bad connection, and Lloyd had too much to think about to want to make it anyway. Red list. Names that Flagg had given to Paul and to no one else, apparently, although Paul had assumed Lloyd knew all about it. Red list, what did that mean? Red meant stop. Red meant danger. Lloyd lifted the telephone again.
"Operator?" "Lloyd again, Cheryl." "Well, Lloyd, did you—"
"Shirley, I can't gab. I'm on to something that's maybe big."
"Okay, Lloyd."
Shirley's voice lost its flirtiness and she was suddenly all business. "Who's catching at security?"
"Barry Dorgan."
"Get him for me, and I never called you."
"Yes, Lloyd."
She sounded afraid now. Lloyd was afraid, too, but he was also excited. A moment later, Dorgan was on. He was a good man, for which Lloyd was profoundly grateful. Too many men of the Polk Freeman type had gravitated toward the police department. "I want you to pick someone up for me," Lloyd said. "Get him alive. I have to have him alive even if it means you lose men. His name is Tom Cullen, and you can probably catch him at home. Bring him to the Grand." He gave Barry Tom's address and then made him repeat it back.
"How important is this, Lloyd?"
"Very important.
You do this right, and someone bigger than me is going to be very happy with you."
"Okay."
Barry hung up, and Lloyd did too, confident that Barry understood the converse. "Fuck it up, and somebody is going to be very angry with you."
Barry called back an hour later to say he was fairly sure Tom Cullen had split.
"But he's feeble," Barry went on, "and he can't drive, not even a motor scooter. If he's going east, he can't be any further than Dry Lake. We can catch him, Lloyd. I know we can. Give me a green light."
Barry was fairly drooling. He was one of four or five people in Vegas who knew about the spies, and he had read Lloyd's thoughts.
"Let me think this over," Lloyd said, and hung up before Barry could protest.
He had gotten better at thinking things over than he would have believed possible in the pre-flu days, but he knew this was too big for him. And that red list business troubled him. Why hadn't he been told about that? For the first time since meeting Flagg in Phoenix, Lloyd had the disquieting feeling that his position might be vulnerable. Secrets had been kept. They could probably still get Cullen. Both Carl Huff and Bill Jameson could fly the army choppers that were hangared out at the Springs, and if they had to, they could close every road going out of Nevada to the east. Also, the guy wasn't Jack the Ripper or Dr. Octopus. He was a feeb on the run. But Christ, if he had known about this Andros What's-His-Face when Julie Laurie had come to see him, they might have been able to take him right in his little North Vegas apartment. Somewhere inside him a door had opened, letting in a cool breeze of fear. Flagg had screwed up, and Flagg was capable of distrusting Lloyd Henreid. And that was bad shit. Still, he would have to be told about this. He wasn't going to take the decision to start another manhunt upon himself, not after what had happened with the judge. He got up to go to the house phones and met Whitney Horgan coming from them.
"It's the man, Lloyd," he said. "He wants you."
"All right," he said, surprised by how calm his voice was. The fear inside him was now very great. And above all else, it was important for him to remember that he would have long since starved in his Phoenix holding cell if it hadn't been for Flagg. There was no sense kidding himself. He belonged to the dark man, lock, stock, and barrel. "But I can't do my job if he shuts off the information," he thought, going to the elevator bank. He pushed the penthouse button, and the elevator car rose swiftly. Again there was that nagging, unhappy feeling. Flagg hadn't known. The third spy had been here all along, and Flagg hadn't known.
"Come in, Lloyd."
Flagg's lazy, smiling face above a prosy, blue-checked bathrobe. Lloyd came in. The air conditioning was on high, and it was like stepping into an open-air suite in Greenland. And still, as Lloyd stepped past the dark man, he could feel the radiating body heat he gave off.
It was like being in a room which contained a small but very powerful furnace. Sitting in the corner in a white sling chair was the woman who had come up with Flag that morning. Her hair was carefully pinned up, and she wore a shift dress. Her face was blank and moony, and looking at her gave Lloyd a deep chill. As teenagers, he and some friends had once stolen some dynamite from a construction project, had fused it and thrown it into Lake Harrison, where it exploded. The dead fish that had floated to the surface afterward had had that same look of awful blank impartiality in their moon-rimmed eyes.
"I'd like you to meet Nadine Cross," Flag said softly from behind him, making Lloyd jump. "My wife."
Startled, Lloyd looked at Flag and met only that mocking grin, those dancing eyes.
"My dear, Lloyd Henreid, my right-hand man. Lloyd and I met in Phoenix, where Lloyd was being detained and was consequently about to dine on a fellow detainee. In fact, Lloyd might already have partaken of the appetizer. Correct, Lloyd?"
Lloyd blushed dully and said nothing, although the woman was either gonzo or stoned right over the moon.
"Put out your hand, dear," the dark man said.
Like a robot, Nadine put her hand out. Her eyes continued to stare indifferently at a point somewhere above Lloyd's shoulder.
"Jesus, this is creepy," Lloyd thought.
A light sweat had sprung out all over his body in spite of the frigid air conditioning.
"Pleased to meet you," he said, and shook the soft, warm meat of her hand.
Afterward, he had to restrain a powerful urge to wipe his hand on the leg of his pants. Nadine's hand continued to hang laxly in the air.
"You can put your hand down now, my love," Flag said.
Nadine put her hand back in her lap, where it began to twist and squirm. Lloyd realized with something like horror that she was masturbating.
"My wife is indisposed," Flag said, and tittered. "She is also in a family way, as the saying is. Congratulate me, Lloyd. I'm going to be a papa."
That titter again, the sound of scampering light-footed rats behind an old wall.
"Congratulations," Lloyd said through lips that felt blue and numb. "We can talk our little hearts out around Nadine, can't we, dear? She's as silent as the grave. To make a small pun, mum's the word." "What about Indian Springs?"
Lloyd blinked and tried to shift his mental gears, feeling naked and on the defensive.
"It's going good," he managed at last.
"Going good?" The dark man leaned toward him, and for one moment Lloyd was sure he was going to open his mouth and bite his head off like a Tootsie Pop. He recoiled.
"That's hardly what I'd call a close analysis, Lloyd."
"There are some other things—"
"When I want to talk about other things, I'll ask about other things."
Flag's voice was rising, getting uncomfortably close to a scream. Lloyd had never seen such a radical shift in temperament, and it scared him badly.
"Right now, I want a status report on Indian Springs, and you better have it for me, Lloyd. For your sake, you better have it."
"All right," Lloyd muttered. "Okay." He fumbled his notebook out of his hip pocket, and for the next half hour they talked about Indian Springs, the National Guard jets, and the Shrike missiles. Flag began to relax again, although it was hard to tell, and it was a very bad idea to take anything at all for granted when you were dealing with the Walken dude.
"Do you think they could overfly Boulder in 2 weeks?" he asked. "Say, by the 1st of October?
"Carl could, I guess," Lloyd said doubtfully. "I don't know about the other two."
"I want them ready," Flag muttered.
He got up and began to pace around the room.
"I want those people hiding in holes by next spring. I want to hit them at night, while they're sleeping. Rake that town from one end to the other. I want it to be like Hamburg and Dresden in World War II.
He turned to Lloyd, and his face was parchment white, the dark eyes blazing out of it with their own crazy fire. His grin was like a scimitar.
"Teach them to send spies. They'll be living in caves when spring comes. Then we'll go over there and have us a pig hunt. Teach them to send spies."
Lloyd found his tongue at last.
The third spy,
We'll find him, Lloyd. Don't worry about that. We'll get the bastard.
The smile was back, darkly charming. But Lloyd had seen an instant of angry and bewildered fear before that smile reappeared. And fear was the one expression he had never expected to see there.
"We know who he is, I think," Lloyd said quietly.
Flagg had been turning a jade figurine over in his hands, examining it. Now his hand froze. He became very still, and a peculiar expression of concentration stole over his face. For the first time, the cross woman's gaze shifted, first toward Flagg, and then hastily away. The air in the penthouse suite seemed to thicken.
"What? What did you say?"
"The third spy—"
"No," Flagg said with sudden decision. "No. You're jumping at shadows, Lloyd."
"If I've got it right, he's a friend of a guy named Nick Andros."
The jade figurine fell through Flagg's fingers and shattered. A moment later, Lloyd was lifted out of his chair by the front of his shirt. Flagg had moved across the room so swiftly that Lloyd had not even seen him. And then Flagg's face was plastered against his. That awful sick heat was baking into him, and Flagg's black weasel eyes were only an inch from his own. Flagg screamed,
"And you sat there and talked about Indian Springs? I ought to throw you out that window!"
Something, perhaps it was seeing the dark man vulnerable. Perhaps it was only the knowledge that Flagg wouldn't kill him until he got all of the information, allowed Lloyd to find his tongue and speak in his own defense.
"I tried to tell you," he cried. "You cut me off. And you cut me off from the Red List, whatever that is. If I'd known about that, I would have had that fucking retard last night."
Then he was flung across the room to crash into the far wall. Stars exploded in his head, and he dropped to the parquet floor, dazed. He shook his head, trying to clear it. There was a high humming noise in his ears. Flagg seemed to have gone crazy. He was striding jerkily around the room, his face blank with rage. Nadine had shrunk back into her chair. Flagg reached a knick-knack shelf populated with a milky green menagerie of jade animals. He stared at them for a second, seeming almost puzzled by them, and then swept them all off onto the floor. They shattered like tiny grenades. He kicked at the bigger pieces with one bare foot, sending them flying. His dark hair had fallen over his forehead. He flipped it back with a jerk of his head and then turned toward Lloyd. There was a grotesque expression of sympathy and compassion on his face, both emotions every bit as real as a $3 bill, Lloyd thought. He walked over to help Lloyd up, and Lloyd noticed that he stepped on several jagged pieces of broken jade with no sign of pain and no blood.
"I'm sorry," he said. "Let's have a drink."
He offered a hand and helped Lloyd to his feet. Like a kid doing a temper tantrum, Lloyd thought.
"Yours is bourbon straight up, isn't it?"
"Fine." Flagg went to the bar and made monstrous drinks. Lloyd demolished half of his at a gulp. The glass chattered briefly on the end table as he set it down, but he felt a little better. Flagg said,
"The Red List is something I didn't think you'd ever have to use. There were 8 names on it, 5 now. It was their governing council plus the old woman. Andros was one of them. But he's dead now. Yes, Andros is dead, I'm sure of it."
He fixed Lloyd with a narrow, baleful stare. Lloyd told the story, referring to his notebook from time to time. He didn't really need it, but it was good, from time to time, to get away from that smoking glare. He began with Julie Laurie and ended with Barry Dorgan.
"You say he's retarded," Flagg mused.
"Yes." Happiness spread over Flagg's face, and he began to nod.
"Yes," he said, but not to Lloyd.
"Yes, that's why I couldn't see—"
He broke off and went to the telephone. Moments later, he was talking to Barry. "The helicopters. You get Carl in one and Bill Jameson in the other. Continuous radio contact. Send out 100 men. Close every road going out of eastern and southern Nevada. See that they have this Cullen's description. And I want hourly reports."
He hung up and rubbed his hands happily.
"We'll get him. I only wish we could send his head back to his bum buddy Andros. But Andros is dead. Isn't he, Nadine?"
Nadine only stared blankly. "The helicopters won't be much good tonight," Lloyd said. "It'll be dark in 3 hours."
"Don't you fret, old Lloyd," the dark man said cheerfully. "Tomorrow will be time enough for the helicopters. He isn't far."
"No, not far at all."
Lloyd was bending his spiral notebook nervously back and forth in his hands, wishing he was anywhere but here. Flagg was in a good mood now, but Lloyd didn't think he would be after hearing about trash.
"I have one other item," he said reluctantly. "It's about the trash can man."
He wondered if this was going to trigger another tantrum like the jade-smashing outburst.
"Dear Trashy, is he off on one of his prospecting trips?"
"I don't know where he is. He pulled a little trick at Indian Springs before he went out again."
He related the story as Carl had told it the day before. Flagg's face darkened when he heard that Freddie Campanari had been mortally wounded. But by the time Lloyd had finished, his face was serene again. Instead of bursting into a rage, Flagg only waved his hand impatiently.
"All right. When he comes back in, I want him killed. But quickly and mercifully. I don't want him to suffer."
"I'd hoped he might last longer. You probably don't understand this, Lloyd, but I felt a certain kinship with that boy. I thought I might be able to use him, and I have, but I was never completely sure. Even a master sculptor can find that the knife is turned in his hand if it's a defective knife. Correct, Lloyd?"
Lloyd, who knew from nothing about sculpture and sculptors' knives, he thought they used mallets and chisels, nodded agreeably.
"Sure.
And he's done us the great service of arming the shrikes. It was him, wasn't it?"
"Yes, it was."
"He'll be back. Tell Barry Trash is to be put out of his misery, painlessly if possible. Right now I am more concerned with the retarded boy to the east of us. I could let him go, but it's the principle of the thing. Perhaps we can end it before dark." "Do you think so, my dear?"
He was squatting beside Nadine's chair now. He touched her cheek, and she pulled away as if she had been touched with a red-hot poker. Flagg grinned and touched her again. This time she submitted, shuddering.
"The moon," Flagg said, delighted.
He sprang to his feet.
"If the helicopters don't spot him before dark, they'll have the moon tonight. Why, I'll bet he's biking right up the middle of I-15 right now in broad daylight, expecting the old woman's god to watch out for him. But she's dead, too. Isn't she, my dear?"
Flagg laughed delightedly, the laugh of a happy child.
"And her god is, too, I suspect. Everything is going to work out well. And Randy Flagg is going to be a dada."
He touched her cheek again. She moaned like a hurt animal.
Lloyd licked his dry lips.
"I'll push off now, if that's okay."
"Fine, Lloyd, fine."
The dark man did not look around. He was staring raptly into Nadine's face.
"Everything is going well. Very well."
Lloyd left as quickly as he could, almost running. In the elevator, it all caught up with him, and he had to push the emergency stop button as hysterics overwhelmed him. He laughed and cried for nearly 5 minutes. When the storm had passed, he felt a little better.
"He's not fallen apart," he told himself.
"There are a few little problems, but he's on top of them. The ball game will probably be over by the 1st of October, and surely by the 15th. Everything's starting to go good, just like he said, and never mind that he almost killed me. Never mind that he seems stranger than ever."
Lloyd got the call from Stan Bailey at Indian Springs 15 minutes later. Stan was nearly hysterical between his fury at Trash and his fear of the dark man. Carl Huff and Bill Jameson had taken off from the Springs at 6:02 p.m. to run a recon mission east of Vegas. One of their other trainee pilots, Cliff Benson, had been riding with Carl as an observer. At 6:12 p.m., both helicopters had blown up in the air. Stunned though he had been, Stan had sent 5 men over to Hangar 9, where 2 other skimmers and 3 large baby Huey copters were stored. They found explosive taped to all 5 of the remaining choppers, and incendiary fuses rigged to simple kitchen timers. The fuses were not the same as the ones Trash had rigged to the fuel trucks, but they were very similar. There was not much room for doubt.
"It was the trash can man," Stan said. "He went hog wild. Jesus Christ only knows what else he's wired up to explode out here."
"Check everything," Lloyd said. His heartbeat was rapid and thready with fear. Adrenaline boiled through his body, and his eyes felt as if they were in danger of popping from his head.
"Check everything. You get every man jack out there and go from one end to the other of that cock-knockin' base. You hear me, Stan?"
"Why bother?"
"Why bother?" Lloyd screamed. "Do I have to draw you a picture, shitheels? What's the big dude gonna say if the whole base—"
"All our pilots are dead," Stan said softly. "Don't you get it, Lloyd? Even Cliff, and he wasn't very fucking good. We've got 6 guys that aren't even close to soloing and no teachers. What do we need those jets for now, Lloyd?"
And he hung up, leaving Lloyd to sit thunderstruck, finally realizing. Tom Cullen woke up shortly after 9:30 that evening, feeling thirsty and stiff. He had a drink from his water canteen, crawled out from under the 2 leaning rocks, and looked up at the dark sky. The moon rode overhead, mysterious and serene. It was time to go on, but he would have to be careful. Laws, yes. Because they were after him now. He had a dream. Nick was talking to him, and that was strange because Nick couldn't talk. He was M-O-O-N. That spelled deaf-mute. Had to write everything, and Tom could hardly read at all. But dreams were funny things. Anything could happen in a dream. And in Tom's, Nick had been talking. Nick said, "They know about you now, Tom. But it wasn't your fault. You did everything right. It was bad luck. So now you have to be careful. You have to leave the road, Tom, but you have to keep going east." Tom understood about east, but not how he was going to keep from getting mixed up in the desert. He might just go around in big circles. "You'll know," Nick said. "First you have to look for God's finger." Now Tom put his canteen back on his belt and adjusted his pack. He walked back to the turnpike, leaving his bike where it had been. He climbed the embankment to the road and looked both ways. He scuttled across the median strip, and after another cautious look, he trotted across the westbound lanes of I-15. "They know about you now, Tom." He caught his foot on the guardrail cable on the far side and tumbled most of the way to the bottom of the embankment beside the highway. He lay in a heap for a moment, heart pounding. There was no sound but faint wind, whining over the broken floor of the desert. He got up and began to scan the horizon. His eyes were keen, and the desert air was crystal clear. Before long, he saw it, standing out against the star-strewn sky like an exclamation point. God's finger. As he faced due east, the stone monolith was at 10 o'clock. He thought he could walk to it in an hour or two. But the clear magnifying quality of the air had fooled more experienced hikers than Tom Cullen, and he was bemused by the way the stone finger always seemed to remain the same distance away. Midnight passed, then 2 o'clock. The great clock of stars in the sky had revolved. Tom began to wonder if the rock that looked so much like a pointing finger might not be a mirage. He rubbed his eyes, but it was still there. Behind him, the turnpike had merged into the dark distance. When he looked back at the finger, it did seem to be a little closer. And by 4 a.m., when an inner voice began to whisper that it was time to find a good hiding place for the coming day, there could be no doubt that he had drawn nearer to the landmark. But he would not reach it this night. And when he did reach it, assuming that they didn't find him when day came, what then? It didn't matter. Nick would tell him. Good old Nick. Tom couldn't wait to get back to Boulder and see him. Laws, yes. He found a fairly comfortable spot in the shade of a huge spine of rock and went to sleep almost instantly. He had come about 30 miles northeast that night and was approaching the Mormon Mountains.
During the afternoon, a large rattlesnake crawled in beside him to get out of the heat of the day. It coiled itself by Tom, slept a while, and then passed on. Flag stood at the edge of the roof sun deck that afternoon, looking east. The sun would be going down in another 4 hours, and then the retard would be on the move again. A strong and steady desert breeze lifted his dark hair back from his hot brow. The city ended so abruptly, giving up to the desert. A few billboards on the edge of nowhere, and that was it. So much desert, so many places to hide. Men had walked into that desert before and had never been seen again. "But not this time," he whispered. "I'll have him. I'll have him." He could not have explained why it was so important to have the retard. The rationality of the problem constantly eluded him. More and more he felt an urge to simply act, to move, to do, to destroy. Last evening, when Lloyd had informed him of the helicopter explosions and the deaths of the three pilots, he had had to use every resource at his command to keep from going into an utter screaming rage. His first impulse had been to order an armored column assembled immediately. Tanks, flame tracks, armored trucks, the whole works. They could be in Boulder in 5 days. The whole stinking mess would be over in a week and a half. Sure. And if there was early snow in the mountain passes, that would be the end of the great Wehrmacht. And it was already September 14th. Good weather was no longer a sure bet. How in hell's name it had gotten so late so fast? But he was the strongest man on the face of the earth, wasn't he? There might be another like him in Russia, or China, or Iran, but that was a matter for 10 years from now. All that mattered was that he was ascendant. He knew it. He felt it. He was strong. That was all the retard could tell them, if he managed to avoid getting lost in the desert or freezing to death in the mountains. He could only tell them that Flag's people lived in fear of the Walkin' Dude and would obey the Walkin' Dude's least command. He could only tell them things that would demoralize their will further. So why did he have this steady, gnawing feeling that Cullen must be found and killed before he could leave the West? "Because it's what I want, and I'm going to have what I want, and that is reason enough." And Trash Can Man. He had thought he could dismiss trash entirely. He had thought Trash Can Man could be thrown away like a defective tool. But he had succeeded in doing what the entire Free Zone could not have done. He had thrown dirt into the foolproof machinery of the Dark Man's conquest. "I misjudged." It was a hateful thought, and he would not allow his mind to follow it to its conclusion. He threw his glass over the roof's low parapet and saw it twinkling end over end, out and out, then descending. A randomly vicious thought, a petulant child's thought, streaked across his mind. "Hope it hits someone on the head." Far below, the glass struck the parking lot and exploded. So far below, the Dark Man could not even hear it. They had found no more bombs at Indian Springs. The entire place had been turned upside down. Apparently, Trash had booby-trapped the first things he had come to, the choppers in Hangar 9 and the trucks in the motor pool next door. Flag had reiterated his orders that the Trash Can Man was to be killed on sight. The thought of Trash wandering around in all that government property, where God knew what might be stored, now made him distinctly nervous. Nervous? Yes. The beautiful surety was still evaporating. When had that evaporation begun? He could not say, not for sure. All he knew was that things were getting flaky. Lloyd knew it, too. He could see it in the way that Lloyd looked at him. It might not be a bad idea if Lloyd had an accident before the winter was out. He was asshole buddies with too many of the people in the palace guard, people like Whitney Horgan and Ken DeMott, even Burleson, who had spilled that business about the Red List. He had thought idly about skinning Paul Burleson alive for that. But if Lloyd had known about the Red List, none of this would have... "Shut up," he muttered. "Just shut up." But the thoughts wouldn't go away that easily. Why hadn't he given Lloyd the names of the top echelon Free Zone people? He didn't know, couldn't remember, It seemed there had been a perfectly good reason at the time, but the more he tried to grasp it, the more it slipped through his fingers. Had it only been a sly, stupid decision not to put too many of his eggs in one basket? A feeling that not too many secrets should be stored?